My name is Joe Salvo, and I am the president of the Copyright Society. First of all, a very warm welcome to all of you. This is our first meeting since the start of the new year, so a happy belated new year. I hope you guys all had a wonderful break, a chance to spend time with friends, family, etc. And everybody's back at it now. Without further ado, let me turn it over to Matt Moore, co-chair of the New York Programming Committee with Craig Mendy.
Thank you, Joe. I'm Matthew Moore, co-chair of the New York chapter of the Copyright Society, as Joe said. Thanks, everyone, for coming this afternoon. We have a very exciting program for you. And just want to quickly acknowledge a couple people who helped put this event together. Theo Chang and Scott Scholder and Bob Clarida. Without them, this wouldn't have been possible, so thanks very much. And I will now pass it on to Craig Mendy.
Just very briefly, I don't need to introduce Bob at much length, and you can read about him here. He's at Reitler, Kalis, and Rosenblatt now. He's obviously been with us for a long time, and Bob and the Planning Committee have had in mind for some time to do a program on politics and copyright. It's a little different from what we usually do, really looking behind the laws, but with the demise of SOPA and PIPA, which I'm sure they'll talk about to some extent, the topic gained more traction, and Shira Perlmutter at the Brace Lecture, if you were at that this year, she discussed what she saw as a real sea change, and she questioned the viability of broad-scale copyright legislation going forward, something akin to the DMCA. She questioned whether that that broad-scale type of legislation would be possible in today's climate. So that's the general topic, but now I'll pass it on to Bob, and thank you very much to our panelists.
All right, thanks very much. The title of the program, Copyright in the Changing Political Environment in Washington, I thought I would just set this up with a very brief bit of context. The 1976 Act passed the Senate 97-0 and the House 317-6. Legislators at the time in the mid-1970s had plenty of reasons to be upset with one another. It was not a bipartisan kumbaya period. Nixon had just resigned, Saigon had just fallen, inflation was 12%. There were a lot of other reasons for legislators to be upset with one another, but they spared copyright that. Copyright sailed through Congress essentially unanimously. The mere 15 years ago, with the passage of Sonny Bono and the DMCA, it was more of the same. It was unanimous consent. It was voice votes. It was not a hotly contested issue. Can we imagine that we'll ever see that kind of support for copyright legislation again in our nation's capital? And with us to discuss that today are Ben Scheffner and Derek Khanna. I'll just briefly introduce them. Ben, immediately to my right, is Vice President Legal Affairs for the Motion Picture Association of America. And he has previously held in-house legal positions at NBC Universal, 20th Century Fox, and he worked as an associate in the Century City office of O'Melveny & Myers. In 2008, he served as special counsel on the presidential campaign of Senator John McCain, where, among other responsibilities, he handled copyright, trademark, and other IP issues for the campaign. He received his JD in 2000 from UC Berkeley and his AB in 1993 from Harvard. Further to my right, Derek Khanna is a Yale Law School fellow with the Information Society Project. He worked on Capitol Hill for Senator Scott Brown and for the House Republican Study Committee. In 2012, Derek wrote a report for the Republican Study Committee on copyright reform titled RSC Policy Brief, Three Myths About Copyright Law and Where to Start to Fix It, which received substantial support from conservatives and the technology community. He has since left the Republican Study Committee and has become involved with a national campaign on cell phone unlocking, which has garnered significant support and resulted in FCC action and congressional legislation. He has also participated in a number of hearings for the House Judiciary Committee, submitted testimony, and filed comments on copyright reform with the Commerce Department and USPTO as part of the Green Paper process. He is a consultant and paid contributor to The Atlantic, National Review, Forbes, and numerous other publications. Received his Bachelor of Arts from UMass Amherst and is a JD student at Georgetown University Law Center. The bio in the material says he received his JD. He's still working on it. And we'll leave some time for questions at the end because I'm assuming that there will be some questions, so we'll try to leave some time before 2 o'clock. And let me just issue a standard disclaimer that everyone is here speaking on their own behalf and not on behalf of any clients or organizations whom they may represent or with which they may be affiliated. So let me just start with my first question, which is a general question just to establish whether there is, in fact, greater polarization around copyright issues now than in the past. And this doesn't have to be a yes-no answer, but just summarize the degree of polarization relative to the past as your experience allows.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you, Bob, and thank you to the Copyright Society for having me. It's always an honor. It's also very scary whenever I do one of these events. I live in mortal fear that one of the, and this is usually well justified, that whenever I mention a case, there's about an 80% chance that somebody in the room actually worked on it and is going to come up to me afterwards and explain that I got it completely wrong. So it's a little bit scary, but again, I appreciate it. It's, this should be a fun event. So to answer your question directly, is there more polarization than in the past? Yes. And the reasons are several. But the fundamental one in the reason that the copyright debate that led up to the passage of the 1976 Act or the DMCA in 1998 or even the subsequent legislation such as the Pro-IP Act in the mid-2000s was that these were basically issues that didn't affect average members of the public. The copyright debate took place between large media organizations, libraries, consumer electronics, the consumer electronics industry, and not really many other major players. And they all represented institutions, and they could be locked in a room and told, don't come out until you've achieved a compromise. That is no longer the environment in which we live. Since the advent of the internet, the rules of the game, the technology is completely different. It used to be that even if you had the worst of intentions and you were an individual sitting at home, you could not commit massive copyright infringement. You just didn't have the technological ability to do so. Obviously, things are different now. A single individual has the technical ability to instantaneously distribute copyrighted works around the globe and make an infinite number of copies. There are obviously rules in place that govern such activity, and for the very first time in history, they could affect average, everyday citizens, who therefore became engaged in these debates. And it is simply no longer the case that major institutional players get to decide these issues on their own. Makes things more complicated, in some ways more difficult, but that's the democratic process, and no one has the right to complain about it.
All right, Derek, could you take that question about whether, in fact, there is more polarization?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me here. I'm really excited to be able to talk about these important issues. Obviously, right now, there's a lot of work going on in Capitol Hill and discussion across the country on the future of perhaps the next great Copyright Act. And actually, as I think actually will happen quite often throughout this afternoon, I actually agree with Ben on a number of his points. Obviously, copyright is becoming affecting more and more people in their average lives in a way that it really didn't in the 18th century when the average person didn't have a printing press and when even translations of a copyrighted work weren't necessarily infringement. But I don't necessarily think that the polarization... I kind of quibble with the idea that because the 76 Act passed and the Sonny Bono Act passed and the DMCA passed so overwhelmingly that these issues have always been settled. I mean, since our founding era, there's always been a large number of questions about what copyright is. Many of the founders, such as Jefferson, were very skeptical of the instrument, but other founders like Madison kind of had a unanimity following the British precedent. But there was some polarization there about whether or not we even needed this instrument. So it's not something where everyone's always agreed. In the 19th century, of course, the Berne Convention was very controversial. And even when Mark Twain testified before Congress, it still didn't sail through for over 100 years. But I think what's starting to happen is, A, some of these regulations are affecting industries directly. And of course, when that happens, they naturally respond in kind. If the MPA tries to strike against Section 512, you're going to hear from all the safe harbor companies. In the 1980s, about 30 years before SOPA PIPA, was when the attacks were going on against the VCR, which is when you heard from all the video rental companies, and they had a massive shutdown across the country. When you went to your local Blockbuster, okay, Blockbuster didn't exist, but your local video rental store, you would walk in, and when you rented your movie, you would sign a letter to your congressman. And there was a protest across the country for multiple days shutting down against the video rental bill in Congress. And when Congress failed to pass that law, they passed very similar legislation for computer software and for music. So I don't think it's an issue where there's always been unanimity on these issues. I do think that today there's unanimity across the political spectrum and in most of the academic world that copyright, of course, is very important and that we should protect copyright. And that's, I go out of my way in most of my work to make that point, which is one reason why I get frustrated when the Library of Congress holds hearings along the lines of copyright is important. Because it's not really a hearing, it's more of a explanation of why of the sky actually being blue.
All right. So both of you seem in general agreement that copyright is affecting more people in their daily lives now than it has in the past. Who speaks for those people in Congress? Is this a Republican-Democratic issue, a left-right-center issue? How does it break down relative to other hotly disputed issues, let's put it that way?
This is not a partisan issue, meaning left-right, Democratic-Republican. We in the those of us who represent media companies have allies and opponents on both sides of the aisle. I mean, I just jotted down, you know, just the list of in the House. I mean, our strongest allies, people like John Conyers and Bob Goodlatte, people like Jerry Nadler and Lamar Smith, people like Ted Deutch and Marsha Blackburn. These people who agree on virtually nothing except for the importance of copyright. Same thing goes for interest groups around town. This is one of the few issues where you'll have people from the AFL-CIO and the Chamber of Commerce walking arm in arm, cheering for copyright. There are various organizations, think tanks on the right and left, that support copyright. Of course, on the other side, those who were more skeptical, there's Democrats and Republicans there. But it's interesting. And there's a variety of reasons for this that we can get into, but it's actually one of the very few issues in Congress that is not subject to the traditional Democrat-Republican or liberal-conservative divide.
Derek?
I do agree that a large amount of it doesn't go along the traditional partisan lens. I think, in my experience, it's more of those who get it and those who don't get the issues. And I think if we extrapolate from those data points, the organizations and members that receive substantial contributions from your organization, we're left with a much more revealing picture. But that's kind of besides the point. But I think on the right in particular, the conservative movement has long had a history that is skeptical of copyright extremism as opposed to constitutional copyright. Constitutional copyright meaning going back to the founding principles and applying that to today. Extremism copyright as in copyright that lasts forever, or copyright that makes it a federal crime for you to unlock your cell phone or jailbreak your iPad. And you can see that with Milton Friedman, Friedrich Hayek, movement conservatives like Phyllis Schlafly, who created the Eagle Forum, presidential candidates like Steve Forbes, Randy Barnett, of course, who is the creator of the arguments against Obamacare, Glenn Reynolds of Instapundit, Judge Posner. Now, they may not agree on exactly what the reforms are that they would like, but they've all been very skeptical of this trajectory that we've been on. I don't see a similar intellectual movement on the left until much more recently. Obviously, you have guys like Professor Lawrence Lessig at Harvard, but I don't see that long trajectory of economists, of movement liberals, that you really see on the right that's quite pronounced. And who can forget during the SOPA PIPA days after that scheduled vote, when in the presidential debate they asked who on the stage supports SOPA PIPA, and every single presidential candidate said that they were against SOPA PIPA.
All right, could I just ask you, just to set up SOPA PIPA. Many of the people in the audience know about it in some detail, but if you could spend a few minutes explaining what the legislation, what the proposal was, and what happened to it.
I'm not sure if we're even going to agree on how to describe it.
That's all right.
Well, try to give it 3 minutes to sort of just refresh everybody's recollection about what was going on.
Well, there are a number of components with both SOPA and PIPA, which had differing ways on going about doing it, but very similar, and obviously there's different drafts of the bills themselves. But they were largely designed to go after large-scale piracy. Part one, of course, was dealing with payments to pirate enterprises, such as the Pirate Bay, for example, saying that MasterCard and Visa shouldn't interact with them. But then some of the more controversial aspects were saying that you create an ex parte proceeding to go against websites that had copyrighted materials. If they were not American-based websites, if they weren't registered in the United States, if there was no nexus to the United States, per my recollection of most of the bills, it would mean that those entries were effectively severed from the DNS, so that way American citizens could not access the bill, which led many experts to testify that by shutting these websites off for American citizens and altering the DNS table, it would fundamentally destabilize the functioning of the internet itself. As well as experts who testify that it may lead to increase of terrorism and child pornography. But we can disagree on the specifics, but that was largely what the bill did.
I take issue with that description, especially the last part. But I do want to push back a little bit on this idea that somehow strong copyright protection is inconsistent with a conservative point of view. I mean, many of our strongest allies among the right-leaning think tanks in Washington, I can list a few of them, Americans for Tax Reform, American Enterprise Institute, the ITIF, which is the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, IPI, which is the I'll get you the full name in a second. These are groups that believe strongly in two things: property rights and the rule of law, which is sort of right down the fairway of what conservatives believe in. And also, I do want to push back on the idea that there's somehow not a tradition of sort of the anti-copyright movement on the left. If you look at what I would refer to as sort of the big three groups in Washington that really devote all of their time and energy to scaling back and, or possibly even eliminating copyright. You have the Electronic Frontier Foundation, you have Public Knowledge, and you have the Center for Democracy and Technology. I would be shocked to find that there is a single Republican working in any of those groups. That is really where all of the energy in the anti-copyright or copyright skeptic community comes from. And it's really on the left. And just to sort of give you kind of a taste of sort of the intellectual inspiration for this movement, some of you are probably familiar with a guy named John Perry Barlow. First became well known as a lyricist for the Grateful Dead, and then became one of the founders of EFF. Now, at various times in his history, he's described himself as a Democrat and actually as a Republican. Others have described him in other terms. And I'll, in 1996, while he was at Davos, he wrote something called A Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace. And this was really sort of one of the founding documents of what I would call the modern copyright skeptic community. This is posted on EFF's website. Barlow was still the first person listed on the board of EFF. And here's what he says. Governments of the industrial world, you weary giants of flesh and steel, I come from cyberspace, the new home of mind. On behalf of the future, I ask you of the past to leave us alone. You are not welcome among us. You have no sovereignty where we gather. And then down below he says, quote, your legal concepts of property, expression, identity, movement, and context do not apply to us. They are all based on matter. There is no matter here. I would describe that as fundamentally anarchist. It's a belief that we have this new thing called the internet. All the rules don't apply. All your silly little governments down there on Earth have nothing to say to us and leave us alone, which I think is fundamentally at odds with a system of based on the rule of law and property rights, which, looking back on our two centuries of history, has served this country pretty well and produced an incredibly vibrant entertainment industry that is the envy of the world. And I think as we embark on this process of copyright review, we should keep that in mind. And there's probably no one on Earth, certainly no one in this room, who would say that the current copyright system is perfect, we should keep in mind that it's actually created an enormous amount of benefit. And at the same time that we have that benefit, we also have an incredibly thriving technology sphere, which, contrary to a lot of sort of doomsaying, has not been crushed by overly oppressive copyright law.
All right.
If I could just respond.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it sounded like Ben was throwing my lot in with an anarchist. John Barlow, I met the guy once, but I hardly think that his statements are emblematic of mine. I think you should read what he was writing. He was saying that in the online environment, you really can't censor a speech, which is exactly what we've seen in Tunisia, Egypt, and all the rest of it. He was talking about property as far as non-rivalrous property goes in 96 or whatever. So I don't really think that that's emblematic of the whole movement, particularly when you're talking about guys like Milton Friedman. Was Milton Friedman inspired by this anarchist statement? Was Ronald Coase inspired by these statements? Maybe they were, because what they did, Milton Friedman in particular, and you know, that was after that. But what about Friedrich Hayek, who's of course created the basis of modern property right theory on the right? What about the statements of James Madison? These guys did not perceive of intellectual property, which is a newer term. Copyright and patents, they do not perceive of those as the same thing as traditional property rights. We see from Friedrich Hayek in his book explaining what property rights are, that it seems to me that beyond doubt that in patents and copyright, a slavish application of the concept of property as it has been developed for material things has done great to foster the growth of monopoly, and that here drastic reforms may be required if competition is to be made to work. He's saying it's not property, it's different than the material property, it's a slavish application of the concept of property, and that we need drastic reforms. 1948, we got Milton Friedman saying almost identical things.
Let me just ask, is the Hayek book still under copyright?
The Hayek book is still under copyright, yeah.
Okay, I'm just wondering. You know.
The book is Individualism and Economic Order, 1948. And again, none of us are arguing that we're against copyright. I'm not against copyright. Madison was against copyright. Friedrich Hayek, Milton Friedman, no one was against copyright.
Oh, okay. About just to go back briefly, because I think it was a real turning point for a lot of members of Congress, at least, who maybe hadn't been paying a lot of attention to these issues, that the SOPA-PIPA debate really sort of took them by surprise from the reports that I heard. Were you involved? Were you on the Hill at the time? And can you just sort of describe what that last week or two was like before the thing exploded?
Sure. I wasn't that surprised. I was surprised at the level of the protest. I was working for Senator Scott Brown at the time, who hadn't taken a stance on SOPA-PIPA but ended up coming out against it the early morning of the scheduled vote. But the reason that people were surprised were the exact reasons that Ben just gave, where he listed off this alphabet soup of organizations and said, look at all the support we get. But what Ben doesn't realize is they support you because you pay for them. Americans for Tax Reform is the top recipient of dollars in the listed filings for the MPAA.
The interest groups on the other side, were they just doing this out of the goodness of their heart? Where do they get their money?
I'm not saying that at all. But my point is you don't have this necessary organic support. You can't quote ATR, ITI, when all of them are receiving substantial amounts of money from your organization. Of course, EFF, public knowledge, I'm sure they receive money across the board. And that's not whom I throw my lot in with. Did Milton Friedman get support from Google? Did Friedrich Hayek get support from Google? Google is not the boogeyman to all of your problems. And so for us working on the Hill, we realized that SOPA-PIPA had major problems. When MPAA, RAA, and Disney came to meet with me and Senator Brown, I asked them a very simple question, which is, if you block something at the DNS level, why can't I access the Pirate Bay at the IP level? In that room, there wasn't a single person who was able to answer the question, because they hadn't been briefed on the distinction between IP and DNS. And that was something that happened across the Hill, was the people who met with members of Congress didn't know what they were talking about. And they said that that issue had been resolved, and then they'd get back to us, and they never did. And I think, when 6 million, I think it was 6 million people reached out to the member of Congress and literally shut down the phone lines, it made Congress shake that day. And after I got asked by members of Congress on every technology bill, regardless of what the topic was, is this SOPA PIPA? Because if it was, they were going to run in the other direction. And that day they heard from their constituents.
To what extent do you think the ease of online mobilization like that sort of has intensified the passions of the forces on either side here? The idea of millions of phone calls or millions of emails or text messages coming into Congress on a copyright issue, I think, would have been inconceivable even 10 years ago.
I think that's right. And look, there's no doubt. I mean, my side lost the debate. We lost the bill. I can't even pretend otherwise today. There are some lessons, though. The other side was very good. They had a single message. If SOPA and PIPA were passed, it would, quote unquote, break the internet. Now, I don't know anybody on earth who wants the internet to be broken. And for people who didn't know a whole lot about the bill and all the safeguards in it and all the judicial process, but were told, hey, if this thing passes, it's going to break the internet. You're not going to be able to watch videos on YouTube anymore. You're not going to be able to go look up an article on Wikipedia. That seems pretty scary. And you know what? Those entities, they use their platforms. They put big banner ads saying, call your congressman or email your congressman, have them vote against SOPA, or they went black. But you know what? Those same days, you could still turn on ABC and NBC and CBS, and our companies, and you can argue about whether or not this was the correct decision, did not use their platforms to make their arguments. We'll see what happens the next time there's a debate like this. And just to point out, again, no doubt the break the internet message was incredibly successful. It was also incredibly untrue. The exact same remedy, the sort of blocking at the DNS level, happens every single day in Europe. Under Article 8.3 of the EU Copyright Directive, there are site blocking orders routinely issued, and they are implemented in this very same way. Is the internet broken in Europe? I think we would be hearing about it today, and it simply wasn't true. Now, we lost the argument. We can certainly be blamed for that. But I don't think the next debate will unfold in the same way.
You made the point, next time there's a debate like this, let me ask if you foresee the next debate like this. Can you see, like, for example, Supreme Court just granted cert in Aereo. Is this going to be a point of contention, a point of mobilization on the part of the forces that took down SOPA PIPA?
I don't necessarily think that's the case. I think SOPA PIPA struck home for a number of people. I would dispute the argument that the content industry didn't defend their own turf. I mean, Rick Cotton, general counsel of NBC, was on MSNBC defending SOPA PIPA against Alexis Ohanian of Reddit. I think that's utilizing your own medium. MSNBC is their major property. When Wikipedia blocked out their website, they were foregoing a substantial amount of revenue, as were many of these other websites. Google, for example, that banner ad on their webpage is the single most valuable piece of real estate in the world, in the economy, online anyways. And, you know, they were choosing to make these decisions that affected their bottom line because they thought it was to their benefit. You know, Wikipedia, I don't think, was a pirate enterprise. So I think it's actually an interesting point. As far as the Aereo case, I don't think it really directly affects people, but I don't think that this digital issue is really what changed it's part of what changed the dynamic. But again, 30 years ago, the video rental companies did something very similar when they shut down their stores for 2 days and people wrote letters to their members of Congress. And so we're starting to see that these, you know, if you do something that's really stupid, you're going to be able to enrage a large amount of people. And that's what we saw at the beginning of this year when the Librarian of Congress made it a felony for you to unlock your phone. And the Librarian of Congress was given that authority because of a bill drafted by the MPAA. And the MPAA, of course, pushed the DMCA in 1998. There wasn't a single vote against it. And then now we know that it makes it illegal for you to unlock your phone or jailbreak your iPad. Well, Americans, when they found out about that, they didn't like it. 100,000 Americans signed the White House petition, the first petition to get to 100,000. The FCC demanded action. The White House came out against its own department. So when these things are actually manifested in people's lives and they actually realize how it affects them, they don't like what's going on behind closed doors. And so the Aereo thing, maybe it doesn't really affect the average person in a way that they know or understand. Aereo only exists in a few markets. But that's really, the SOPA PIPA example is the beginning of something new.
Right, well, that takes me to my next question. Is this a new normal? Intense polarization something that we just have to learn to live with going forward? Or do you see perhaps a day when it's less contentious?
Look, if you spend all your time on the internet and read the copyright blogs and these forums, you'll think that everything is incredibly contentious. There's actually people who work in this world and get things done. There's a lot more cooperation than you might see publicly. I mean, you want to set up this battle between movie studios and Google. Every single one of the movies of the major movie studios has commercial deals with Google. These are people who get in a room, sit down, and work out deals that are to their benefit. I mean, you think about something like YouTube and the Content ID system that YouTube has implemented. I mean, started out with this incredibly contentious system where copyright owners would send millions of DMCA takedown notices for all the infringing material on there, and Google would reluctantly take them down, and then somebody else would repost them, and it was this endless and ultimately kind of pointless exercise. Well, you know what? Google realized they weren't going to make a lot of money on this stuff. It wasn't reliably up there, and advertisers didn't want to just put their ads next to cat videos. They wanted professionally made content. So they implemented this technological solution which either blocked or allowed for monetization of commercially developed material and split ad revenue. That's the kind of thing which doesn't get as much attention as, you know, protests on the internet, but is really a lot more representative of what's going on the ground than I think the average person knows about.
I think Ben says something interesting there, which is that there's a lot more cooperation in these fights than you may recognize, which is the problem. And you can't trot out Google as the boogeyman when at the same time you're saying that we cooperate with them every day. Because what happens is if there's an issue that you're promoting that Google isn't against, then it sails through without debate because there's no lobbyists on the other side. There's no one representing the other side of the argument, which is why the Sonny Bono Act, of course, had no one lobbying against it, to my knowledge. And what big tech company was there saying, no, we don't want life plus 70 years? Today, what tech company is lobbying against the TPP treaty? And so as a result, you have amount of the academia world saying, wait, these policies don't make any sense. They're inconsistent with the Constitution. They're actually going to hinder economic growth, content production, innovation. But they're not represented in Washington, D.C. And so SOPA PIPA was an example of that fissure coming to light. It wasn't Google that made that happen. It was 6 million American people who were sick and tired of this.
All right. If you had to brief a new member of Congress, an incoming member, on the top 5 IP issues to be on the lookout for, the top 5 landmines to avoid, the top 5 policy opportunities to seize, what would they be? And you don't have to hit 5, but if you can even hit a few, that would be very helpful.
Well, I'll tell you what we do. And I'm sure other industries do exactly the same thing, and including industries in Northern California, which is they don't necessarily focus on the contentious things where things aren't working. But we take members of Congress and we show them the movie making process. We show them from the entire development process to physical production to how distribution works, and we talk about the billions of dollars of investments that we make and the risk that is entailed in every single decision whether to greenlight a movie. We talk about things like, I always focus, and this is kind of old-fashioned, but you know, we talk about the big copyright disputes, things like Aereo, is it legal, is it illegal? I like to focus on things where it's copyright is unquestionably working. Things like the theatrical distribution system. This is really old-fashioned. It goes back, 80 years. But you know what? When a movie theater wants to show a movie in its theater, if it did it without a license, it would obviously be violating the copyright owner's exclusive right to publicly perform the work. So what do? They get a license, and they work out these deals, and it's approximately a 50-50 split. And you know what? There's virtually no such thing as a pirate movie theater. the system works. That is how copyright is supposed to work. And I think focusing on things like that rather than the stuff that's not working is an excellent way of sort of educating people about copyright. Because I think, again, these things get much too contentious, and we fight about things on the margins sometimes without showing how copyright is truly works in practice.
Same question to you. If you were briefing a new member of Congress.
Well, I've done it, and I think this copyright's important. Look at all the movies we make. Isn't that great? Now support our agenda is kind of emblematic of what's wrong in Washington, D.C., which is, of course, copyright's important. Of course, the movie industry is terrific, but that doesn't mean that we should be passing these bills that do completely opposite things. I think in the next, the next 5-10 years, the issues that Congress is going to be dealing with, first and foremost, is the cell phone unlocking issue, which I launched, which I wrote legislation for and has now passed the House Judiciary Committee, which, just to make it simple, it's a federal crime for you to take your phone, plug it into a computer, alter the phone settings so you can use AT&T's phone on Verizon's phone after your contract has expired. And that's because of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And I would love if in this panel the MPAA was able to come out and say that wasn't actually our intention in 1998 when we wrote the DMCA, because there was no such thing as a digital phone, and we'd actually support now for millions of Americans not to be felons for unlocking their phone, or 4 million Americans for jailbreaking their iPads.
Well, that's actually not an accurate description of what the DMCA actually says. There's no the criminal aspects of that only come in when it's on a commercial scale. So an individual unlocking his cell phone is never subject to criminal sanction. That's just a misdescription of how the bill actually works.
You're grossly incorrect. I don't know what to tell you here, because the analysis that I put together has been endorsed by scholars from Harvard, Yale, Stanford, Georgetown Law, and there's never been a counter perspective written by anybody. So if you have a counter perspective, write it in a law journal, and we'll read it and we'll debate it.
The analysis that I wrote
has been endorsed by the White House, by the FCC, by Chairman Goodlatte, and in the Congress. So I don't know where this new analysis is coming from, because
Section 1201.
Yes. We've all read Section 1201, and if you don't think it should be a federal crime, then I hope you'll support legislation making it clear to Americans that it should not be a federal crime. And when businesses get letters in the mail saying you have to shut down your company that provides unlocking services, that's not going to fly anymore. So that's point one. Point two, 2019, we're going to have copyright extension up on the docket again, life plus 90 years. That's going to be contentious.
Okay, just for the those of us who don't know, why 2019? Why will it come up again in 2019?
Steamboat Willie.
Oh, Disney Corporation. 1928 was the...
The Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, of course, is going to be finalized sometime and will come up before Congress and this year.
What are the terms of that treaty? What does it attempt to do?
Well, I mean, I could talk about what I've read publicly. Of course, Ben here has basically written the treaty, so I don't think...
I've never even seen the treaty.
He's a busy guy.
Well, this is a treaty being negotiated in secret by about 500 of the content industry's representatives. Tech companies have been denied the ability to access it. As a congressional staffer, I was personally denied the ability to read the treaty. Members of Congress weren't allowed to read the treaty until very recently. The leaked text that we have from August, which of course could have changed, included, among other things, codifying an international treaty copyright terms of life plus 70 years, with Mexico proposing life plus 100 years, America not against, recodifying provisions of the DMCA that would make unlocking your cell phone a crime, and a numerous other aspects, including statutory damages, which is pretty incredible because Congress is supposed to be analyzing copyright reform right now, and then we're codifying through international treaty exact copyright law from today, which seems like you're moving the ball down the field.
Let me just interrupt for a second, because that's actually not what Chairman Goodlatte said. Bob Goodlatte, Republican congressman from Southwest Virginia, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. After Registrar of Copyrights Maria Plante earlier this year gave a speech calling for, quote, the next great copyright act, Chairman Goodlatte kind of took up that baton. And what he said is this: we are going to do a review of how the current Copyright Act is working. He was very explicit. He did not say reform. He said review. That's what they're embarked on. He announced there's been approximately 4 hearings so far. The latest was just this morning. And what he announced is that they're really going to start, they're going to march through virtually section by section of the 1976 Act. This morning, there was a hearing on the scope of Section 106. In another week or two, there's going to be one about Section 107, fair use. In a few weeks, there's probably going to be one about Section 512 of the DMCA, et cetera, et cetera. This is going to go on for some time. There's a lot of sections of the Copyright Act, as you know. And it is not a foregone conclusion at all that this is going to result in new legislation. Again, this is a review. It's not a reform process. And one thing that I like to remind people, the process that that culminated in the passage of the 1976 Act. Does anyone in the room know what year the actual sort of review process that started and then culminated in the 76th Act? Is it? What, 64, I heard?
Oh, in the 50s, Arthur Fisher said.
1955, correct. 21 years between when they started and when it eventually passed. Now, I'm not predicting that that this is going to take 20 years. I'm also not predicting that it's going to, again, culminate in a complete rewrite of the Copyright Act. The point is, we're at the relative beginning of what's going to be a lengthy process where Congressman Goodlatte, who's a strong supporter of copyright, is in good faith leading a review to see how things are currently working.
But again, he's leading a review, but the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty is your insurance policy, which is you can review it, you just can't backtrack on anything that we've written into substantive law. And you know, there is a distinction here, because Maria Palante in that speech said that we needed to consider having copyright terms where the last 20 years are opt-in, where you have to pay some sort of a fee, you get those last 20 years. And for me, of course, I don't think that that's really enough. Life plus 50 years still seems like an awful long time when the founder's copyright was for 14 years. But life plus 50 years is different. Life plus 70 years is in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty. So we are negotiating for a treaty that makes it illegal to implement the proposal given by the Register of Copyright, which is the reason why we have this review process. So it can make you feel better to call it a review rather than a reform, but I think everyone knows why we're having this.
Chairman Goodlatte to call the review, not us.
I mean, that's fine. The other issues for discussion, of course, are going to be statutory damages. We have the Commerce Department going through the green paper process, which I filed two comments for, on whether or not statutory damages are working in the modern economy and how we can look at some of the particular reforms, which, again, is recodifying the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty and the Judiciary Committee is taking a look at. I think Congress is going to need to really deal with the incredible statutory damages that we've implemented here. Leading individuals to be potentially liable for billions of dollars in damages, and leading companies to be scared to do anything involving content. I'm reminded of a quote from Paul Graham, founder of Y Combinator. He has a, I don't know if you've heard of Y Combinator, it's a website where you can submit your idea for a new company, and they invest in you and bring you out to California to kind of walk you through the process. And he says, we can help you with pretty much anything that you do unless your startup involves anything touching music. Because, quote unquote, the record labels are effectively a rogue state with nuclear weapons. There is nothing we or anyone else can do to protect you from them except warn you not to start startups that touch label music. And that is the sentiment I hear across Silicon Valley, which is that companies cannot innovate in anything involving content today, unless they get the approval from the MPAA and RAA, see Spotify. And so what that means is content is increasingly affecting everything. It's affecting our phones. It's affecting our video game consoles. It's affecting machine equipment you get today where it may have a GPS restriction on where you can move that machine equipment. It's really affecting modern day innovation. And smart companies are starting to realize that they can go after their competitors. The phone unlocking provision was done because AT&T wanted to stick it to T-Mobile, and they won. Today you're seeing Neighbor City and Three Taps being destroyed by their competitors through copyright being abused. And so as this becomes more emblematic, you're going to have Congress be forced to reconcile the two. Do we want to choose innovation or innovation and content creation? My vote is both.
The notion that there is no innovation.
I didn't say that there's no innovation. That's a baloney argument.
The notion that there is some dystopia where everyone's running around Silicon Valley scared to death of doing anything involving content is nonsense. There are currently in this country 95 services to access movies and television. I don't know how many there are on the music side. this is an explosion. These things didn't exist several years ago. Can you invent a new service that retransmits, redistributes others' copyrighted works? No. You also can't say, I believe in copyright and that everyone should be able to do that. There are 95 legitimate licensed services in order to view movies and television shows. I do not think copyright law is somehow crushing innovation. We see new versions of these services emerging every day, and we have to be careful lest all these entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley invent services and there's no music or movies or television shows to put on them.
But this is what I mean, is fundamental to capitalism is the idea of the corporate shield, where the CEO of a company is not personally liable for the conduct of his company. We all know this. We learned this in law school, right? Well, it doesn't apply for copyright litigation. And that meant that MP3.com CEO Michael Robertson was personally liable. What else do we know that kind of helps capitalism function? Well, venture capitalists, when you invest in a company, if the company goes under, you should lose your investment, right? Well, in the case of Napster, the investors in Napster didn't just lose their investment, they got personally sued. And they had to settle for, I forgot what it was rumored to be $60 million, much more than their investment was. And same with MP3.com when they got sued. Of course, the company, Vivendi, that was suing them bought MP3.com at the end of the litigation and then turned around and sued Cooley, their law firm, for malpractice because Cooley had advised them that their market model was presumptively lawful. If that does not create a deterrent effect for an investor or for an entrepreneur or a lawyer, I don't know what does. We have Michael Robertson describing what happened to him as a very effective campaign of terror. We have Business 2.0 reporting that BMW chose not to incorporate MP3 players in their cars because they were worried about secondary liability, which is a reason why when you go abroad, they have those little USB sticks you can put in the car, plays MP3 music. It's terrific. And so we don't actually know what we don't have today. We know that the Rio was sued into oblivion. We know that Replay TV was sued into oblivion. We know that in the United States, we never got the digital audio tape, but every other country in the world did. And some of this litigation you in this room may be familiar with. This litigation is very familiar to people in Silicon Valley.
All right, I'd like to open the floor up to questions. We've got about 10 more minutes, and I think probably there are some questions in the room. So anyone want to start with a question?
Just to add, I can source anything that I've said if you.
I will start with a quick, big, general question as people put their hands up for more specific things. Given the speed of technological change, is Congress even the right venue for whatever changes may be needed? Putting the specifics of policy aside, what we need to do to fix copyright, is Congress really institutionally capable of doing it given the speed of technological change? Should we leave it to markets and the courts? We see increasingly courts are saying, I just anecdotally read a lot of copyright cases, and very many of them now end with a judge saying, well, this is really a problem for Congress to deal with. Is it? Should it be? Should maybe the courts take a more active role and say, Congress is not going to fix this, we have to do something?
Well, I don't think they'll have a choice. Again, I don't think, certainly not in the next few years, are we going to see a whole-scale rewrite of the Copyright Act. And just to sort of broaden the issue a little bit, I mean, Congress doesn't do anything these days. They don't pass anything. So, a fortiori, they're not going to do anything on copyright. It's a larger problem than those that are concerning us in this room today. So, yeah, people are running around the country spending tens of millions of dollars litigating Aereo and Aereo Killer. Is this a public performance? Is it not a public performance? What does the transmit clause written in 1976 actually mean? You know what? The courts don't have a choice but to tell us because I think it's unlikely that Congress is going to clarify that within the next 2, 3, even 5 years.
Derek, do you have a different view about whether the courts should take a more active role in resolving some of these issues?
Well, I'm a conservative. I really don't like the idea of the courts doing much of anything. But in this situation where Congress has been so unable to actually grasp on these complicated issues or actually have a real hearing, I mean, when they have a hearing on the cell phone locking issue that I led and they didn't invite anybody from our campaign or a single legal scholar that had written about it, they They wrote a bill that had been written by the industry, and when it was opposed by pretty much every outside organization, and they didn't invite any of those organizations to speak. That's just how Congress works. And having worked in Congress, you know that there are real hearings and there are fake hearings. And the question is, are they going to have real hearings on copyright? Are they going to have real hearings on statutory damage levels? Are they going to have real hearings on some of these innovation questions? And so the neighbor city example that I mentioned before, they cut out the middleman for real estate. They say, if you want to buy a house, we're going to rate your real estate agents based upon MLS data, multiple listing services data. And they cut out the agent, meaning that they cut down the commission. So customers love this stuff. And what does MLS do back? They sue them for copyright infringement, saying that they have a copyright to the data of the MLS database, which, of course, is the price that the house sold at, the location that the house sold at, et cetera, which I think all of us will agree on this panel, under Feist, is not copyrightable data. But how does that happen? It happens because of statutory damages, because they can sue neighbor city and sue them into oblivion and put the threat of liability in the hundreds of billions or trillions and ask for the CEO of neighbor city to be imprisoned. That is not an isolated example. And that's what Congress needs to deal with. That, of course, is not the job for the courts to deal with.
All right. Question over here.
Hi. You mentioned that you find the current regime to be sort of restrictive to entrepreneurs and to innovation. How would you address the counter-argument that actually it should really be expanding innovation in that it's the Silicon Valley example you mentioned, that's actually creating the need to recognize pre-existing quality work that is in demand, or companies will be forced to create their own content. For example, you have Netflix with House of Cards, Orange is the New Black. They were forced to create that own content, partially, I would assume, because of the high cost of acquiring other desirable shows.
All right. Did everybody hear the question? All right. Anyone address that?
I'm not sure if that was the reason why Netflix created. I think they chose to create their own content because they thought they could do a better job because they used data. That was my impression of House of Cards anyways. But it reminds me of what Kevin Spacey said when he won an award for House of Cards, which is that if you give people what they want in a manner that's accessible for them, then more often than not, they're going to pay you for it. And I think that's a lesson that the movie industry and the record industry is starting to learn.
All right. Another question? Yeah.
What is non-rivalrous property?
Okay. Question. What is non-rivalrous property? You mentioned it earlier in connection with Hayek, I think.
Sure. I don't know if you want a dictionary definition. I mean, non-rivalrous traditionally means a property that more than one person can't occupy at once. Of course, it has other dimensions as well. Property rights for physical property versus intellectual property have different attributes.
All right. Any other questions? Just one more that I will end with then. Is it the case that copyright is somehow more contentious than other IP issues? Because I know we just had a very significant reform of the patent statute. Patent law certainly touches on innovation and technology at least as directly as copyright law does. And yet Congress did enact, and the President did sign, a major revision of the Patent Act. Does that offer us any kind of hope for copyright?
I think there's major differences. I mean, it goes back to what I said at the very outset of this hour, which is that copyright now affects everyday individuals. Patent law, not so much. There's a lot of criticism of so-called patent trolls, and I should point out, MPA member studios are often victims of some of these patent trolls, and we signed on to letters in support of some of the recent reforms. But patent law is not affecting individuals in the same way that copyright has. It hasn't become so polarized, whether it's fortunate or unfortunate, I mean, I don't think there's a lot of parallels in terms of the way that legislation will actually play out.
I think he's largely correct. But the reason why it hasn't become as polarized is because in patent law, there's always been multiple parties to the discussion. There are some companies that just created some brand new device, and there are other companies waiting on the sidelines saying, I really want that new statin drug. And so you constantly have this push and pull, factions fighting factions, if you will, to take parlance from Federalist 10. But we don't have that with copyright. With copyright, there's only one side who says we want longer and longer and longer copyrights, which is what we have, of course, since at least 1976. And that's why you're seeing copyright issues become much more contentious. when there's no other side that's actually there for the discussion. And the patent issue, of course, the perspectives that aren't at the table, that aren't represented by companies, fall by the wayside. And so what I mean by that, what is the proof in the pudding? Well, patents terms are very similar today to when they were in the founding era. Today they're 17, 20 years. The founding era, I forgot the exact terms, but it may have been 14 years. Copyright, of course, when it was created for 14-year terms, renewable if the author is still alive. Today is life plus 70 years. There's simply no comparison between those two expansions. One is a minor expansion, and the expansion of copyright is exponential. And with the patent reform, what I meant is you have companies asking for reform, companies asking against reform. But there's no one at the table saying we have too many patents. But in the academia world,
actually, there are a lot. That's
actually one of the major arguments that played out.
I agree with that perspective, of course.
No, there's lots of people saying, you know what, the PTO is doing a bad job. They're letting through too many bad patents. That's a major topic of the debate.
The lobbying has happened from companies asking to go after the patent trolls. There isn't a major company lobbying to change how the PTO is granting patents. And that's where the real issue is in patent reform, and that's what the academics seem to really want, left, right, and center. And that issue not being substantively wrestled with is emblematic of exactly what I'm talking about, which is industry capture.
All right, well, I'll just finish like John McLaughlin with a five-second question for both of you. What's the next copyright bill that Congress is going to pass? Derek Hanna.
One of the cell phone locking bills, H.R. 1123 or 1892.
Ben Schaffner.
No major copyright legislation for several years. I think orphan works, though, will be a major topic of debate where I think there could actually be consensus.
Thanks very much. It's been a great pleasure.